talk about cultural intelligence, there's four aspects of it. We talk about cultural intelligence in terms of drive, you know, your level of motivation, which can be intrinsic and extrinsic. And another aspect of cultural CQ drive is what we call self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is that ability to actually bounce back. And sometimes we make mistakes, and I may not know the correct way of doing things, but I still give it a go, right? I still jump into it. And that, for me, is a great example. Self-efficacy is really important when it comes to cultural intelligence. The other aspects are knowledge. Of course, you need to understand, have a fair, you know, understanding of different aspects of any particular culture you're spending time with. Some people tend to know it in more depth, other people a lot less. That then feeds into your strategy. And when we talked earlier about negotiation, so therefore you go into every culture having a different strategy in place based on your knowledge. And then the fourth part is execution, action. You know, how do I actually put it into play?
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi, innovators. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I trust you enjoyed our most recent interviews with Julia Streets of Streets Consulting and Steve Glaveski, the author of Employee to Entrepreneur. I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Tom Virgus, an internationally renowned consultant, presenter, executive cultural coach, author, and founder of Cultural Synergies. Tom has over two decades' experience working in the field of cultural intelligence, taking him to over 40 countries. Working with diverse business leaders around the world has provided Tom with an international perspective and experience as a specialist consultant who equips organizations and their teams, his clients, with the skills to effectively work within and across cultures. His focus is cultural intelligence, inclusive and ethical leadership, and the promotion of sustainable global leadership and high-performing international teams. Today's episode is brought to you by the Transformational Marketing Hub, where you'll find a host of free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. You can access the hub at InnovaBiz.co/VIP. If you don't have an account yet, don't worry, just click on the blue Take a Peek Inside button. As I said, it's free and exceptionally useful, and it will transform your marketing. In our discussion today, Tom talked to me about what it means to be culturally intelligent. Also, being culturally agile and building your repertoire of communication skills and self-awareness and knowing your own culture and cultural filters. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Tom Virgus. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome today to the InnovaBuzz podcast from about half an hour up the road from me in Melbourne, Australia, Dr. Tom Virgus. He's an internationally renowned consultant, a multiple book author, a presenter, an executive cultural coach, an author, and a founder of Cultural Synergies. Welcome to the podcast, Tom. It's a great privilege to have you as a guest.
Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast, Jürgen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oscar Trimboli, who was our guest on episode 168 of the podcast, suggested that we interview you, Tom, and so a big hello to Oscar.
Yes, Oscar is a very good a consultant. He's someone I've known for a long time, actually, in his days when he was at Microsoft.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So we go back a long way, and he's, you know, done a great job as a consultant, specifically focusing on the area of listening, which is critical, of course, in any human interactions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, your expertise is working in human interactions, as you said, across cultures, and you use the term cultural intelligence and building inclusive and ethical leadership, as well as promoting sustainable global leadership and high-performing international teams. Now, as someone who works with people all around the world now and staff in various locations, I'm really looking forward to unpacking those topics with you some more today. So I'm excited to have you on the podcast. Now, before we start talking about all things global leadership and cultural intelligence and high-performing teams, tell us a little bit about your background. Give us a bit of a snapshot of how you got to where you are today and what some of the pivotal moments were in that journey.
Sure thing. Well, I was born and brought up in Malaysia, Jürgen. My parents are of Indian heritage, Indian ethnicity. They went over to Malaysia to work, and I was born and raised there. And I came out to Australia as a foreign student many years ago. And then, you know, started working here in Australia. And in the 90s, I went back to university because you may recall we had a recession here at that time. Yeah. And I actually lost my job and couldn't for the life of me find another one. So decided to go back and finish my education. And part of doing my master's thesis, I was looking for a topic, and one of my friends at that time who was visiting here from the US, he was living here, he was doing some work here, his name was Ed Trost, he said to me, Tom, you should look at this area called cultural diversity. It's very big in the US, it'll probably be very big here. So when I started reading about it, and especially when I started reading around intercultural, it just resonated for me. Growing up in Malaysia, it's a very multi-ethnic. We learn how to navigate our way through the cultures at a very early age. So it just made a lot of sense to me. And I thought, wow, there's actually literature on this. There's research on this. There's information on this. And that's how I started in the arena. And that's going back now 27 years ago.
Okay. So did you grow up in Kuala Lumpur?
I grew up in a small place outside of Kuala Lumpur, between Kuala Lumpur and Penang, in a place called Ipoh. It's a small town. Actually, a small town outside of Ipoh called Batu Gajah. It's a very small town, probably about 8,000 people.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I never got out that far. I visited KL quite a lot, but never got out that far. All right. Well, so one of the things you mentioned was growing up in that multicultural society gave you insights that you kind of grew up with and that you took for granted. How did you then evolve from that area of things that you'd kind of learnt from a very young child and taken for granted to absorbing all the studies that were going on in that space and then marrying all that together to kind of develop programs and training and consulting help?
Well, Jürgen, I think, you know, I've been very fortunate in my life. I'm very fortunate in my consulting. When I was actually looking at doing the research for my master's, there was an airline here at that time called Ansett Australia. I'm not sure whether you remember them.
I had over a million frequent flyer points to them that I lost. Know them very well.
You would have been a gold or platinum or something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Super platinum. So anyway, at that time, Jürgen, they had just started flying into Asia. Expanding out from domestic to international, and they were having quite a number of challenges with some of their Asian customers or Asian guests. And someone then put me in front of them, and they asked me to help their teams understand how to, you know, interact how to serve their Asian customers better. So that's what they were my first, in fact, my first cross-cultural client. And I did an 18-month longitudinal study with them. That was my master's thesis. And they were great clients to work with. I met some really wonderful people there. And I had a lot of fun, working there, learning from there. And then, of course, you know, the best way to learn anything is to teach it. Mm. And because I was teaching it, I was able to bring a lot of the theoretical perspectives into play.
Yeah. Yeah, I had an interesting experience that kind of talks a little bit to culture with ANZIT, and it would have been around that time when they started flying internationally, and I was traveling to Nagoya. I think they flew into Nagoya.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah, into Japan, yeah.
And I booked the flights to make that trip, and I thought, well, I love ANZIT. Really, as you said, wonderful people, great service always. And so I booked in this flight without giving it a second thought. And then when I checked in, they upgraded me to first class as well, which was wonderful, of course.
Right. And
then I ended up sitting next to a woman in first class that chain smoked.
Right. And
what I didn't realize was flights into Japan were not smoking free at that time. And of course, I was used to going on flights and not expecting that you have to ask for non-smoking because they're all smoking free, except the flights to Japan with ANZIT. So, and I must have put on a really sad face because the cabin attendant came up to me and said, "Oh, well, oh, that's right." And I'd swapped seats as well. I'd swapped seats so that a married couple could sit together. So I wasn't even in my own seat.
Right.
And anyway, so the cabin attendant came up and really pampered me on the trip to try and mitigate this nasty circumstance. And then when I left, they gave me a bottle of Dom Perignon champagne. So they're really concerned about my well-being.
Yes. Well, those were the days, right, when you could actually do those things.
Yeah.
Smoke on airplanes and things like that.
Mm. Anyway, cultural intelligence is something you talk about quite a lot in your business and also in the books you've written. So what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, cultural intelligence is defined, Jürgen, as the ability to interact effectively with people from different cultural backgrounds. So if you think about, in fact, you know, in the early days, this used to be really known as cross-cultural training and or cross-cultural education, because people would want information on a particular culture, right? They would be saying, okay, well, I'm going to Japan, so, teach me about the Japanese, or I'm going to China, teach me about the Chinese. You know, but today it's very difficult to do that because someone may visually or, you know, physically, they may look Chinese, but they may have grown up in the United States, they studied in France, they worked in Spain, they may be married to somebody from Brazil. Do you know what I mean? Like it's just a very different mix now. So when we talk about cultural intelligence, it's fundamentally how does one develop the ability to be culturally agile? How do I work with people of different cultures and how do I be effective in those situations?
Yeah, I like the idea of culturally agile and bringing flexibility to that to work with the different people. But I was reminded because I mentioned before we started recording that I work for an American company and there are a lot of Asian immigrants or, you know, often first and second generation Americans that were of Asian descent who worked for the company. And there was one particular chap I remember who was given an assignment to relocate to China. Now, he didn't even speak the language and he was told, well, you're Chinese, so we'll send you there. And, of course, this was a massive issue for him because essentially he was an American that looked Chinese.
Yep.
And when he was in China, they saw a Chinese and expected him to speak the language. And when he didn't speak the language or spoke it, you know, he made an attempt and spoke it like a foreigner, then he was treated with even less respect than if it had been a Westerner.
Yes. And that used to be traditionally the way we would just send somebody because ethnically they are from that part of the world. But in fact, people like that had more difficulty dealing with the locals because the locals had the expectation that you're from here, so why didn't you speak the language? As compared to somebody who looked foreign, at least you knew they didn't have the language. And so they were far more forgiving of that.
Yeah, yeah. So what are some of the cultural beliefs that we all have inherent in us and that we need to kind of be more aware of and be more flexible around when we deal with other cultures?
Well, I don't know whether we all have it, Jürgen. I suppose, you know, that's one of the things that constantly we talk about. Are there some universal values? And of course, you know, you can, you know, one can argue, well, you know, we can have the universal value of, say, family, love of family, or kindness, or generosity, etc., which are all kind of considered to be universal values. The challenge actually is how it gets depicted or represented in different cultures. So let me just give you an example of that. So here in Australia, you know, work-life balance is something that's is considered important in the workplace here. So, you know, people would try to work and finish and get back in time to demonstrate actually a commitment to their family. Now, in other parts of the world, say a country like Singapore, for instance, or Malaysia, you may find, in fact, people work a lot longer. They may work till 7, 8, or 9 o'clock. But really, that is to demonstrate love for family.
Yeah.
So both behaviors are demonstrating love for family, but it's just done in different ways. The challenge becomes is really in how we interpret those behaviors, because when we interpret behaviors, we tend to use our own norms, our own values, our own systems, our own standards, and thereby judge another culture, which is where it becomes problematic.
Mm. Yeah, and in thinking back to some of my travels internationally, and this did applied all across the world, as you say, there were different ways that people displayed, say, that love and commitment to family that was probably common in all cultures that I came across. And at the same time, when I was visiting somewhere, of course, the after work time, often people would feel that they had a duty to look after me, to entertain me, to take me out, show me the sights, or sometimes they'd invite me home to their home, although that's a level of kind of closeness that, again, it's probably a story around that in terms of culture and being invited home on a professional level. But certainly from my point of view then, I was always like, you know, I'm happy to look after myself. I don't want you to take time away from your family. And so there was always this kind of dance that you had to, on the one hand, respect them for looking after you and give them the opportunity to do that. On the other hand, saying, well, look, you know, I don't want to really take you away from your family or whatever you might have on in your private time.
Yeah. Well, I think that also demonstrates, Jürgen, the whole value of hospitality in some of those cultures. And so you can see where one of the issues that occurs, and this has happened a lot, is then people from, say, those parts of the world, let's use India as an example, you know, where they'd be easily, happily take you out for dinner, show you the sights, etc. They come over here and they expect that same sort of level of hospitality. And of course, you know, in most times it doesn't occur because people wrap up work here and say, okay, fine, see you later. Bye for now and see you tomorrow. And so it's that interpretation of, well, why I'm doing it over there, but why don't they do it over here? You know, so it's all those things that we have to actually unpack and get people to understand, because otherwise your biases kick in and you create meaning on those behaviors.
Yeah, I like that in terms of, you know, assigning a meaning to a behavior that may really not be the intent there.
Correct. Mm. Yeah. So I think, you know, in most times, the intent in most times is always good, right? I mean, I tend to try to think that for most times when you're working across cultures, the intent is mostly good. It's just how it gets interpreted and how it then lands on the other side.
Mm. Yeah. One of the things that always fascinated me, and I think, you know, it's a challenge that everybody faces, particularly if it's a remote working relationship, is building relationships where you don't have in-person, face-to-face communication every day.
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on how to manage that?
Well, I think, you know, for a start, you've highlighted that it's extremely difficult. And of course, in today's world, many, many people work in virtual teams, working across borders, working across distance, working across time. And the further you are located away from your colleagues, so we call that cultural distance, the more difficult it becomes. So as a leader of virtual teams or as a leader who's working remotely with people from different cultures, you have to be very conscious of looking at how do we create activities that can help build relationships.
Hmm. Yeah, I come across a lot of people that manage virtual teams, and a lot of them complain that, you know, there's turnover or people don't take initiative or people aren't committed to them or their company. And I believe a lot of it comes back to what you just said in terms of how they build relationships and how they create that environment that allows a virtual team to operate as a team.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example of this, Jürgen. You know, last year I was visiting a client here in Melbourne, and it was Monday morning. Our meeting was at 8:30. We went in, we had some coffee, and I was obviously talking to her. You know, we were doing the small talk, which happens during the winter season here in Melbourne. Mm. Is we were talking about the football, right? It was the, you know, did you watch the game? Which team you support? You know, the normal kind of small talk that occurs.
Yeah.
Football. So then I mentioned to her, I said, when you talk to your team in a couple of hours' time in China, do you in fact engage with the same level of small talk?
Hmm.
And she paused for a moment and she said, no, I don't. Because by that time, I am already in full swing.
Yeah.
I've already been at it for two and a half hours. And I'm, you know, I don't even think about pausing and asking them about their weekends. Mm. Because all that's already been done. So that is an example of some of those soft things that we forget in virtual teams.
Yeah, and I think part of it possibly comes back to the fact that because there's a connection involved in terms of technology, whether it's phone or video conference or online tool, that it kind of becomes formal. It's a meeting rather than you've just met in the coffee room and you have that conversation.
That's right. That's right. Yes. So leaders have to be very conscious when they're bringing a team together, how we would normally in a face-to-face meeting, you know, you spend a few minutes at least just chewing the fat, saying hello, talking about whatever, you know, the weather, etc. You find many a time in a virtual meeting, we tend not to do that because we have an agenda. We tend to have a limited amount of time and we tend to get on with it.
Mm. Yeah, I think one of the things that works really well today, though, is with technology around. I mean, there's all these live chat software that you can have running all the time if you're at a desk and at a computer, and basically be having a conversation on a casual basis right throughout the day rather than having it as a formal meeting. And you can
That's right. You could still have the
formal meetings, obviously, when, you know, okay, we're going to deal with a topic and we're going to formally have a meeting. But at the same time, you can have the casual questions or casual conversations. And another thing I've seen that works really well is having just a channel within one of these online tools, having a separate channel that's just family or hobbies. So encouraging people then to post in there, what did you do on the weekend? And if particularly if people have young families, they sort of post photos of their kids doing something on a weekend or, for example, if the kids have achieved something at school. So it gives everyone a sense of getting to know people at a more personal level.
That's right. Yeah, and which is exactly what it is, Jürgen. It's getting to know people at a personal level, which, as you can appreciate, is much easier to do when you're face-to-face, right? Mm-hmm. Because you are taking a lot of cues from the individual when you're sitting across a table from them or having a cup of coffee or having some food with them. You know, the conversation tends to be very different as compared to when you're in a meeting or when you're doing it online. So it's about how do we create that personal time? How do we get to know people beyond that professional identity?
Mm. Okay. Now, one of the other things you talk quite a bit about is negotiating across different cultures and mm-hmm. building agreement frames. So tell us a little bit about what's a good approach to a negotiation that might be a little counterintuitive to what people might do if they're just working inside their own culture?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's about understanding what is your preferred way of negotiating. So if we think about culture, one of the challenges about culture is, you know, I get asked a lot when people say, listen, can you teach me about the other?
Mm.
Right? Can you talk to me about the other? And we get a lot of calls. I mean, I'm going to negotiate with, you know, Japan. I'm going to negotiate with the United States. I'm going to negotiate with China. Can you teach us some things about, you know, the 10 key points I need to understand about the Chinese? You know, and I will always say, you know, Google it. You'll find it much easier on Google. You get all that in Google because that's not the area that we work in.
Hmm.
Bullet points are not what we work in. So if you can imagine visually, if you think about an iceberg, you got 10% of the iceberg that's above the waterline. That's what we see. 90% is below the waterline. So the stuff that's above the waterline are the things that we see of cultures, right? We see food, we see clothes, costumes, color, buildings, you know, what we call symbols of culture. Hmm. But it's the things that's below the waterline, your values, your perspectives, your religion, how you deal with gender, how you deal with authority, how you push back, how you deal with conflict. All those things are very much tacit. In other words, they are, you know, if you are part of that culture, you just know rules. And if you're external to the culture, you just don't know that. So what we try to then do is look at, well, how do we understand that? And before you can understand any culture, it's really important to explore your own. So what's your own cultural values? What are the things that's really important for you, critical for you? How do you operate? Because everything is relative to you, right? So culture is subjective. So I'm going to look at another culture based very much on my own style and my own value set. So let me give you an example of that. In Australia, we consider ourselves to be quite direct. You know, we tend to call it as it is. We're pretty much straight shooters. I was working with a client here, and she was saying about how she was visited by some of her senior leaders from the United States, particularly from New York. And they delivered some information to her team, she said, which was so amazingly straightforward and candid. They had the team in tears. And she said to me after that, she said, I thought we were straight. It was nothing compared to them. So I said, there you go, right? It's all relative. It's subjective. Whereas Australians, we go maybe to Indonesia, the Indonesians consider us to be so direct, so abrupt.
Mm.
It's relative. So it's about understanding your own culture. And if you understand your own culture, then you'll start understanding, okay, what's my style? So if we think about negotiation, what's the style of negotiation? So if you look at the stages or phases of negotiation, it's not that it's very much different, but it's, so for instance, in relationship building, you know, how much time do we invest in relationship building? Say, if I'm in a negotiation here, how much time do I invest in relationship building here compared to, say, if I am negotiating in, let's say, Germany or France or the Middle East?
Mm.
You know, there's always a relationship building phase. It becomes, well, how much time do I spend here and how aware am I of that and how do I invest that time? That's where the differences come in.
Yeah, that's interesting. And in some ways, we look at things through the perspective of our own biases as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think
absolutely. So it's our lenses, right? So yeah. One of the definitions I use of culture is, in fact, it's the lens through which you look out at the world, right? So it's your worldview. You know, we look at our worldview through our own lenses, based on our own experience, our education, our upbringing, our schooling, you know, all those things impact who we are and how we look out into the world.
Yeah. And in the example you gave there, you know, and then we attach meaning to things. So in the example you gave there, some people might have said, well, the team from the US are pretty rude.
Yes.
And not caring.
That's right.
On the other hand, the people from Indonesia may say that about the Australian team, but the Australian team may say of the Indonesians, well, you know, they're hiding something because they don't give us all the information.
It's really hard to
know what they're thinking.
Yeah. And they're not explicit and they don't, you know, they beat around the bush.
Yeah.
They take a long time getting to the point. What are they talking about?
Mm.
You know, so I think those things all come into play. I worked for a large property company here in Australia who were doing some major investments, in fact, in the United States. And, their negotiators, and I worked with them, and they were saying for them the biggest difference that they noticed, they said in Australia, the field is small. So even though you are negotiating with somebody on the other side, what tends to happen is, you know, you leave something on the table because you just never know when you're going to face them again, right? You know, you'll see them again somewhere else.
Yeah.
They'll turn up somewhere else. Their experience in the U.S. was very, very different. In the U.S., it was just very much hard-nosed.
Mm.
It wasn't, I'm getting the best that I can in here because it doesn't matter. You know, we move, you may move, I'm not going to see you again. It's a very different mindset. So they come into it with a very different mindset.
Mm, that's interesting, yeah. Because I've kind of certainly experienced situations like that where I wondered, you know, this is very much geared towards win-lose.
So, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, win-lose, right? You know, which, you know, obviously in smaller markets, as you can appreciate, it's very difficult to do, right? Because, you know, the shoes may be reversed, right?
That's right, yeah. And also, you know, we talked about building relationships. Win-lose doesn't really do wonders for a relationship.
That's right.
So if you cross paths again later on and the relationship is damaged, well, it's going to be really hard to do business.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in a highly relationship-based cultures, you know, it's very much around the long game.
Mm.
Like you need to play the long game. You need to have that point of view.
Mm. And what's your view? Because I know you gave an example on another podcast I listened to about a negotiation, and it may have been China it was Korea, I think, where the feedback was given in terms of, that was a very interesting presentation, and the people giving the presentation interpreted that as that they were in with a strong chance of getting the business, whereas what was actually being conveyed was, no, we're not interested.
That's right.
In a very polite way.
Yes.
So The other thing, of course, you know, what I was thinking there is if you pick that up as a no, in the West, we tend to make that mean that that's a no forever.
Yeah.
And also it's a no for future opportunities, whereas the whole thing is really fluid, isn't it? And
that's correct.
You can continue to build a really good relationship there, even though that particular business hasn't succeeded.
That's correct. Yeah. So in that example there, for instance, you know, where they misinterpreted the response, in actually on a second phase, you know, because we worked with them, you know, with this particular individual who was a very, you know, I mean, I regard this individual as a highly culturally intelligent individual now. But what this person started doing is in future when he heard statements like that, rather than taking it for face value, he started asking further questions to understand it deeper.
Hmm.
You know, so it's just more around getting deeper into the questions rather than accepting it at face value. So, and it's also, we have to consider, Jürgen, that, you know, in most places, you're talking to people, if you're talking to people for whom English is not their first language, there's always a slight process that of time it takes for interpretation, framing, the right words, you know, all these sort of things that come into play, which we need to also be considerate about.
Mm. Yeah, well, certainly, again, working for an American company, my experience was that not many people spoke any other language, and so then they expected the rest of the world to speak English as well as their language. And yet when you go to most parts of Asia, most parts of Europe, you find that people typically speak about three, sometimes a lot more languages plus English.
That's correct.
And they speak those three really well. So their language skills are far superior than most native English speakers. And yet, we, as English speakers, we kind of make the assumption that they're at a disadvantage.
That's correct. That's right. And in fact, sometimes one of the challenges in those sort of scenarios becomes we attribute levels of intelligence to language capacity.
Mm.
So, for instance, you know, if you think about multinationals, one of the areas I work in is developing Asian leaders. You know, for years, one of the challenges when you work, especially for large corporate Western multinationals, it was very hard to find good talent in places like Asia. And when you start questioning that and delving into it deeper, you really will start finding out just because they don't speak the language well, and the language here meaning English.
Mm.
Oh, well, you know, that must mean they're not that smart. Do you know what I mean? So these are all the biases, and they're unconscious, Jürgen, right? They're just unconscious biases that come into play.
Yeah, that's right. And my experience in the past has been that, you know, it's no more or less difficult to find wonderful people, you know, exceptionally talented, gifted people in any part of the world than it is in any other part of the world. But like you say, if you make the language skill or something else that may be culturally determined mean that they're less intelligent, then again, it's looking through your own filters, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's looking through your own filters. So one of the aspects of cultural intelligence that we talk about is really being aware of your own filters.
Hmm.
Right, you know, which obviously takes a certain level of self-awareness, a level of reflection, a level of introspection.
Yeah, I really like that because obviously that's all within your own control and power. So you mentioned earlier about being culturally agile and, of course, having the flexibility to adapt to different situations and, you know, the different environments that you might find yourself in when you go to different countries and the things that you can influence are your own filters and your own self-awareness.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So when we talk about cultural intelligence, there's four aspects of it. We talk about cultural intelligence in terms of drive, you know, your level of motivation, which can be intrinsic and extrinsic, and another aspect of cultural CQ drive is what we call self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is that ability to actually bounce back. And sometimes we make mistakes, and I may not know the correct way of doing things, but I still give it a go, right? I still jump into it. And that, for me, is a great example. Self-efficacy is really important when it comes to cultural intelligence.
Mm.
The other aspects are knowledge. You need to understand, have a fair, understanding of different aspects of any particular culture you're spending time with. Some people tend to know it in more depth, other people a lot less. That then feeds into your strategy. And when we talked earlier about negotiations, so therefore you'd go into every culture having a different strategy in place based on your knowledge. And then the fourth part is execution, action. How do I actually put it into play?
Yeah, I like that framework. It's really good.
Mm.
One of the things I think people find this challenging at the best of times, but what are your recommendations for dealing with feedback in a cross-cultural situation where, let's say, you have a team and you want to provide some feedback to help them improve?
One of the things is it's always useful to develop a repertoire for giving different types of feedback. So there is what we call the direct feedback method, right? Which is just going from A to B, boom, there's no padding at all. Most people would be familiar with the sandwich model or the hamburger model.
Mm.
We say something good and then we give the negative feedback and then we finish off with something good. Some people may be familiar with what we call the open sandwich model, which is, you give the negative feedback and then you finish off by something good. But other times in certain cultures, you need to actually be able to give the vegetarian model, which is no meat.
And what does that look like?
You need to be able to tell stories, Jürgen.
Yeah.
You need to tell stories. You need to be able to use analogies, metaphors,
mm-hmm.
So that you're talking about it in a third party. So you're maintaining face, but you give an example of someone else.
Okay, so you basically dissociate the person from the event.
Correct, yeah. So let's say, for example, somebody in your team, in what we call a high context culture, which is where the language is much more circular, indirect. Let's say they were doing a presentation, they didn't do a good presentation. So we can either give them some direct feedback on the presentation, which would be appreciated in what we call low context cultures. But in other cultures, you may just want to tell a story. You may tell, there was a time when I was actually working in another country and this particular person did a presentation. Unfortunately, it didn't go well at all. And the impact that it had was, the clients didn't trust this person. They didn't go ahead with the proposal. That person lost credibility within their own team. Do you know what I mean? You make that as a story.
Yeah.
And so that, and what you're wanting, and if you say it well enough, this person that you're talking to, they'll pick it up. They'll know. They'll get it.
Yeah. Even if it's only at an unconscious level, right?
Correct. Mm. You can kind of just talk about that. What would you do? What do you think that, and you may ask questions, what do you think that person did in that situation?
Mm. And would you do that with positive feedback? If they've done a fantastic presentation and you wanted to point out the things that were really good?
Absolutely. You want to obviously reinforce the things that were good. So it's much easier giving, in fact, positive feedback than it is negative feedback. And I think that's a global phenomenon, right? It's just that in certain cultures, people are more open and they're much more open to receiving it. And they take it as being straight. So, if you're talking, the Israeli culture, for instance, is quite direct.
Yeah.
They would expect you to give them very frank, direct feedback, and they will give it back to you.
Hmm.
but they don't get upset about it. Whereas other cultures would get, as we were talking before, they'd feel hurt.
Yeah.
They'd say, well, why can't you say it in a nice way? Why do you have to be so, you know, blunt about it?
Yeah.
So it goes back again to the values that you place, right?
Mm. Yeah, and I guess one of the core things there is having the empathy to know what's appropriate in a given situation and really understanding how to do that then. I mean, one of the things I find a little frustrating with feedback in general is often, and particularly this is true of positive feedback. So somebody will say to me, for example, oh, that was a really good presentation, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I will think, well, you know, my ego's been stroked, but that was really of no value at all, that feedback, because what was good about it? You know, what worked?
Yes.
What did you really like? And, you know, was there some other stuff that could have been done better, that I could have done better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't specific enough, right? Mm,
that's right.
So in that situation, you know, one could argue then it's up to you to actually say, well, so what was good about it?
Yeah.
What did you like about it?
Yeah, which comes back to the example you gave earlier about the negotiation and following up with some more specific questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
And of course, you know, the thing is, like, when the better you get to know people, the closer you develop the relationship. You know, of course, the whole culture piece then suddenly doesn't become as important, right? Because you're now relating to them as an individual. You've got to know them personally. And that shifts. That makes a lot of difference. Because even though there may be things that you're unclear of or unsure of, you actually feel you can actually raise the question.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess that, again, that's universal, isn't it? That's not a cultural thing, although maybe in some cultures to get to that level of personal trust and being able to be very direct, let's say, in the communication takes a little longer.
That's right. It takes a little longer. You know, because if you think of one of the biases, which is affinity bias, and affinity bias says that, you know, we tend to trust people who are similar to us. You know, we trust people who are similar to us. So as human beings, we are looking for similarities. And so that's why, you know, we are always, you know, if you think about the general small talking thing, you know, where did you go to school, you know, what did you do, what's your work, etc. We're looking for common points, common reference points. And of course, if you come from a similar cultural background, you have a lot more common points, right? There are more touch points.
Yeah.
As compared to somebody who's coming from a very different culture to you, the touch points are different. Now, they may have families and they may still work and they may still do different, but their hobbies will be different, right? You know, somebody may go skiing compared to, you know, running on the beach. And it's just this is just the whole kind of weather, sport, type of food they eat, entertainment, all those things then starts impacting how they live their lives.
Mm. That's right. To me, that was always part of the fascination of being in a different place, like looking at the foods, you know, exploring the different foods and then understanding from the locals what, you know, what went into that food or if it was visiting somewhere that had some, you know, some location that had a particular significance and trying to understand what did that mean and how did they relate to that. So that was always a great way to start that sort of conversation or finding common ground.
Indeed.
Hmm.
And that's a great example, Jürgen, of CQ drive. So yeah. that demonstrates your level of motivation. You were interested.
Hmm.
You asked questions, right? All that demonstrates drive. You know, and there are people who are in international roles who don't have that. And that makes it very difficult.
Hmm.
Because they take on the role sometimes because of the promise of promotions, right? They want a bigger remit. They want greater responsibilities in the organization. So it's an extrinsic motivation. They're doing it for other reasons.
Yeah.
They don't have that intrinsic motivation. So, and again, it's not that you need both, but I think, you know, if you have the intrinsic, then it also helps you navigate some of those other things, like, you know, actually asking the questions about the food, right? Being actually interested in what happened here, or, you know, what's the historical perspective of that?
Mm.
Which makes it kind of, again, it's about trying to get more common points, right? More touch points.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a lot around, because I was interested, you know, it was really around taking the opportunity to learn some new stuff. And like you say, the motivation really was just to get some more variety, learn some things that I didn't know at that point. But the benefit of that, of course, was that, yes, it did create those touch points.
Indeed.
And often what would happen was, for example, around food, asking those questions, and then the other person would come back and say, well, don't you have that in Australia, or haven't you? What about in Germany, where you're from?
Yeah.
And then, you know, often the person would then ask a question, well, what's unique about the food where you come from?
That's right.
And then all of a sudden you've got a conversation and starting to build that relationship on common ground.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Hmm.
I would think the other factor as well, Jürgen, which would have helped, would have been the fact that you also experienced being in a different culture. Now, as you mentioned, right, you know, you're of German descent, but you grew up here in Australia.
Yeah.
And then you went back and lived in Germany. So you've had cross-cultural experiences, and that helps develop a level of empathy.
Yeah, I think it's as you mentioned earlier, with your background growing up in Malaysia and then with Indian heritage and cultural influence there, plus all the multicultural environment in Malaysia and then moving to Australia. So, yeah, I think, you know, I'm not sure we might have had this conversation before we started recording, but the it's kind of inborn in some ways, and in that situation where we've come from. And so to me, sometimes a lot of this stuff was common sense, and I wondered why other people didn't behave like that. In those environments.
That's right. Is that old saying, right? Common sense is not necessarily common.
That's right. Yeah, not so common.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think some people find it a lot easier to deal with ambiguity. Some people can find it a lot easier to deal with higher levels of stress. Some people can deal with, you know, eating food that they're not familiar with, whereas other people can't.
Hmm. All right. Well, this has been fascinating, Tom. I could go on for ages talking about this stuff, but I think I'm looking at the clock and conscious of the time. So I think it's time we moved on to the buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field.
Okay.
And get some tips from your experience that hopefully will give them something to inspire them to do something awesome today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what do you think is the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Oh, I think you need to stop and allow time for reflection.
Mm. Yeah, that's really good. It's amazing what happens when you do that and just clear your mind.
Mm.
All right.
We're not too fast now. We're too busy. You know, people are always busy.
I find that going out for a morning bike ride, and some people go for a run, just sort of zone out with some physical activity or something like that, that gives you that time for self-reflection.
Mm.
All right, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Well, I think, you know, based on that first point, definitely reflection, but also, you know, I think my meditation practice helps.
Mm-hmm.
I find that's always kind of a useful way for me. And I find the other thing that is useful is because I travel, I tend to travel quite a bit. I just love that time of undisturbed peace in an aeroplane.
Yeah.
you know, where I can just zone out and just allow. There's something that comes from just allowing the mind to explore different ideas.
Mm. So do you meditate daily?
I do, yes. Practice, yeah. Mm. It's a practice I've incorporated now probably for the last 8 years. Yeah, I picked it up from my mother. My mother was always meditated for, you know, 70 years. I mean, ever since she was a young. I always grew up knowing her to meditate. She always could get up at 5 a.m. to meditate. Mm-hmm. And I've, you know, picked it on and off and always had difficulty doing it. She passed away in 2011. And it's a commitment I made to myself that it would be a practice that I would incorporate from her.
Mm.
So I've maintained that. You know, not easy at times. You know, sometimes I do go for, you know, there are a couple of days, a few days where I just kind of don't, but then I'm back into it. It becomes a practice, right?
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, we call it a practice simply because there's no end goal. Just something you just keep doing.
I mean, Well, it becomes a habit, I suppose, and then, then it's just part of your routine.
Mm.
All right. Mm. What's one of the resources that you use most often?
For what, innovation?
Yeah.
I engage with people. So I find people are a great source of ideas. I tend to very much sound people out on ideas that I have. So, you know, they may be just half-baked, or I may have things that I'm not sure about, and I have a trusted group of advisors, people around me. So even when I'm creating programs, or I want to try new activities, or I want to try new frameworks, I always tend to sound it out with people who I know, because I find their feedback is invaluable.
Mm. Yeah, and I think there's a lesson to be learned from that with anyone that's creating products or programs, as you say, just test it out with people and get the feedback.
Mm.
All right, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
I outsource it to my assistant. That is not my strength, Jürgen. So, you know, I'm a big believer in working on your strengths.
Yeah.
You know, so being kind of methodical, working through on timelines, that is not an area of strength for me. I'm far more on the creative side.
Yeah.
But I do have somebody who works with me who is very much on that. So she keeps us on track, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, there's a good lesson in that, and that's to have people that can do the things that you're not good at, because I think that's one of the keys to actually succeeding in business is to surround yourself with people that add to your strengths and take on tasks that you're not really good at.
That's right. Yeah. So it's about diversity, right? It's leveraging on the diversity. Yeah, so, you know, how do you get diversity around you? So different ways of thinking, different perspectives. And of course, you know, when you're working across cultures, that's a key thing that you're trying to get leaders to appreciate. It is about diversity and different perspectives.
Mm. Okay, well, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
I think, you know, it's important for individuals to realize actually that they are a brand. You know, so you are a brand.
Mm.
And so like all brands, you know, what do you stand for? How do people talk about you when you are not in the room? So that requires a level of self-awareness. And I think if you think of yourself as a brand and, you know, if you can list, you know, here are the things I want to be known for, that is going to be your differentiator.
Mm. That's great advice. And I like the analogy of thinking of yourself as a brand, because effectively you are, whether you want to be or not these days, right?
Mm.
And with social media and the ease with which people can review businesses or individuals that provide service online, that's essentially all of that is part of your brand.
Yes, that's correct.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks, Tom. This has been really great. Where can people reach out to find out more about you and maybe even say thank you?
Well, you can certainly find more information about what we do on our website, which is www.com. www.culturalsynergies.com.
Okay, and we'll post links to that in the show notes for people to click through directly. What's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner then who wants to be a leader in their field?
Well, I think if you want to be a leader in any field, you need to think about it as a long game.
Hmm.
So it's not a short game. It's not a let's get in there, let's kind of do it fast and let's get out. I think you need to think about it as a long game. So in other words, I'm going to be a leader, you know, in whatever field, you know, it's going to take me, say, 10 years.
Hmm.
What do I need to do? What do I do to build up my brand, build up my credibility, build up my body of work, build up my network? But, you know, it takes time. That's my perspective, and that's kind of more one of my bias, as a leader, that's what's required.
Hmm.
And there'll be other people who kind of disagree with that and say, no, you can go in quick and do it fast. So I think it just depends on, again, your own perspectives, your own values. But for me, it's always a long game.
Hmm. Well, I think the danger of doing it fast in the sense of maybe you have a big breakthrough of some product or something that's new on the market is that often a lot of those things disappear as quickly as they turn up. So even if you do have a quick success for whatever reason, I think the long game strategy is still a good one because, once that product has outlived its life cycle, then there's something else you might want to do.
That's right. Yeah. And you get, you'll get referrals and things like that. You know, I mean, I just finished a project in Malaysia working with three different organizations, bringing them together on a major project. And in fact, one of the ways I got a reason I was working on that was I was referred into that project by the person who's now a chairman of that company who was in one of my programs 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I don't even know who that individual was. I didn't remember him. He didn't, but he knew my work. He remembered me. He said, oh, we should just, get him to come in and do some stuff on it. So, I think for me, that's the example of the long game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your personal brand.
Yeah. That's a really good example. All right. Well, thanks, Tom. Finally, who would you like me to interview on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
Oh, I would probably recommend Duncan Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Duncan Smith is a consultant in diversity and inclusion.
Okay.
I would recommend him.
Where's he based?
He's based here in Melbourne, the hills in Melbourne.
All right. Well, we might get an introduction from you and get Duncan on the podcast as well.
Sure thing.
So, thanks.
With pleasure. Thank you, Jürgen. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing your time and insights with us today. I've really enjoyed it and learned a lot. So wish you all the best for the future and let's keep in touch.
Indeed. All the best now. Bye for now.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed that insightful and engaging conversation with Tom and, like me, learned a lot from what he shared. Some of the highlights for me were the idea of being culturally agile and bringing behavioural flexibility to your interactions with people. And let's be honest, that applies to any interactions with people, whether it's across cultures or not. And the idea that he presented of the CQ drive. I'd love to know what you took away from Tom's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/TomVergus. That is TomVergHese. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/TomVergus. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Tom there, as well as links to the Cultural Synergies website, his book, The Invisible Elephant, and the other resources we spoke about in the conversation.
Tom suggested we interview Duncan Smith, a highly experienced organisational consultant working in the area of diversity and inclusion, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So Duncan, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Tom Vergus. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/VIP to access the Transformational Marketing Hub and all its free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. Also, check out our Tales of Marketing Transformation show at talesofmarketingtransformation.com, where each episode will provide one valuable message to guide you on your journey of marketing transformation. Tune in again next week to the InnovaBuzz podcast. We've got more fantastic guests lined up, including Jackie Lappin of Speakertunity and Robin Kennedy from Response Suite. Stay connected. Subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you'll make sure you'll never miss another episode. Head on over to innovabiz.co/subscribe. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because what you think matters to us. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions, or questions, then share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic Facebook community at the Tales of Marketing Transformation Facebook group. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co/TMA. It's free to join. I hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.